WQED in Pittsburgh. It's host Fred Rogers.
Mr. Rogers?
Yeah.
I want to tell you something.
What would you like to
tell me? I like you.
I like you, my dear. Thank you very much for telling me that.
If you take all of the elements that make good television and do the exact opposite, you have Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Low production values, simple set, unlikely star. Yet, it worked.
Hello. I've always felt that I didn't need to put on a funny hat or jump through the hoop to have a relationship with a child.
He was always trying to get a message across in every show.
A week on death.
What does assassination mean?
A divorce.
Some people get married, and after a while, they're so unhappy that they don't want to be married anymore.
He was radical. I know everyone says that, but he was radical.
They didn't want black people to come and swim in their swimming pools. My being on the program was a statement for Fred.
A neighborhood was a place where, at times, that you felt worried, scared, unsafe, would take care of you.
He had a singular vision of kindness and love.
Love is at the root of everything. All learning, all relationships, love or the lack of it. Children have very deep feelings, just the way everybody does. There must be times when you do feel blue. I'm not feeling blue right now, though.
Me neither.
Won't you be my neighbor? Well, I suppose it's an invitation. It's an invitation for somebody to be close to you. The greatest thing that we can do is to help somebody know that they're loved and capable of loving.
Won't you please, please won't you be my neighbor?
I feel like we should have some popcorn. I keep showing you movie previews. I'm not getting kicked back. I can stream that now. Well, I don't know about your family, but in my family, there are often different versions of what went on in it, which is why who at age 36 tells me he loved being swept away into the imaginary world of kings and ladies and talking kittens and skunks and tigers. And that is what Fred Rogers had hoped for when he had got at least temporarily sidetracked from a straight vocational path into ordained Presbyterian ministry, which is where he was headed, when he decided instead to go into the television industry. He was interested in transmitting what he saw as the basic Christian value of loving your neighbor. He often admitted that he actually hated TV, hated it, especially the shows that were being produced for young children, which he saw as inundating them with demeaning, pie-in-the-face slapstick and manic pace. And God knows, Mr. Rogers did not have a manic pace. I'm going to read that. Instead, he wanted to use what he called the fabulous instrument of television, that amazing small screen, to share what has been described as his deep and simple faith in a beautiful, noble, sacred life with kindness as its foundation. Kindness as its foundation, not just to grab children's attention, but to teach children and through them, all of us, what it means and how it is to be human. That was his mission through public television. Now, the opposite, unkindness, was also familiar to Fred Rogers. Biographers tell us that he struggled as a young boy making friends and was frequently bullied for being overweight. Can you imagine Mr. Rogers being overweight? Taunted as Fred, as Fat Freddy. Actually, in the documentary that some of you might have seen, he does many, many laps across the swimming pool every day, and then he weighs himself. He weighed himself because he's passed. He weighed 143 pounds his entire adult life. So he got away from being Fat Freddy by a lot of work. According to one writer, he had a lonely childhood, making friends with himself as much as he could. He had a ventriloquist dummy, he had stuffed animals, and would create his own worlds in his childhood bedroom. So you see the elements for Mr. Rogers' Neighbor. By the way, I didn't ask, how many of you saw and seen it over on Comic-Con? Okay. So what did he have? He had puppets that he spoke. He had his stuffed animals, and he created his own world. So that's where it came from, a very lonely childhood in a suburb, I think, 40 miles from Pittsburgh. Starting behind the scenes, away from the television camera, Fred was given an opportunity in February of 1968, when the larger neighborhood of this country was in the thick of the Vietnam War, to have his own daily 30-minute children's television show on the public radio or television station in Pittsburgh. It was in black and white, so it was not possible those first few years to see that when he came through the door every day, it was in a red coat and a coordinated tie, and he would go to the closet for his, what I remember to be, red cardigan, but blue cardigans are fine as well, and thank you for putting one up for us, and change into his purple sneaker, which he was in no hurry finishing lacing, if you remember, as he greeted you, his television neighbor and friend, by saying, "Won't you be my neighbor?" On that very first show, that very first black and white show in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, declaring, "I like you just as you are, your facial composition, your special disposition, I wouldn't change you or rearrange you." And in that very first week of programs, taking the program's themes directly and indirectly from what was actually happening in the world, which children cannot escape, alluding to the Vietnam War, showing King Friday in a conflict, building a fence around his kingdom. In that first year alone, dealing with the assassinations of Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert Kennedy, he dealt directly with them in a deliberate, calm, passionate way, while emphasizing, as he always did, that expressing feelings of fear and anger was important for children, and that it was the role of adults to respond to them, to reassure them, and above all, to keep them safe. In 1971, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood moved to PBS big time and color television. with a short hiatus during which time Rogers tried to bring his same approach and messages to adult audiences in various formats with much, much less success. In fact, if you look at the clips of him trying to talk to adults the way he talked to children, it was relatively painful. He returned not so much due to his lack of reception in adult land, but because he became disturbed over reports of children injuring themselves, even being killed, attempting to imitate superheroes. Children that would get on top of tall buildings, for example, and try to fly. I mean, this was really true. He wanted to help them understand the difference, which he always made on his show, between reality and fantasy, and to help keep them from harm. Whether in direct conversation or make-believe dialogue, one writer tells us that from the murderous year of 1968 through the last episode, which happens shortly before September 11th, 2001, he took American childhood and Americans in general through some very turbulent and very trying times. Throughout the show's long run, he was pretty much a one-person, low-tech show who wrote all the scripts, created all the characters, did all of the voices of all of the puppets, dealt with children fears, all of them, and difficult subjects, all of them, from divorce to death to terrorism. On an episode in 1969, he invited the neighborhood police officer, Clemens, to join him. How many of you have seen this? In cooling off by dipping their bare feet in a kiddie wading pool. Sounds kind of innocent, just dip your feet in the wading pool. The character, played by operatic tenor and actor Francois Clemens, was among the first African-Americans to have a regular role in children's television. And the simple scene of them washing their feet together was a direct and gentle challenge to still segregated American swimming pools. In another episode, the theme was mistakes. A puppet, Skunk, is playing hide and seek, and when someone comes upon him suddenly, he gets frightened and accidentally sprays this friend. A very smelly situation in the neighborhood of make-believe. Everybody makes mistakes, he is told. Daniel Tiger, who was said to be Roger's surrogate on the show, tells Lady Aberlin, one of the real actors in the neighborhood of make-believe, that he had been wondering about making mistakes. He was smaller, he said, and tamer than other of his fellow beasts. He did not look the same. Am I fake? Daniel asked. Am I a mistake? Am I a mistake? You are. You're fine as you are, Lady Aberlin assures him. You are my best friend. I love the way you look. I love the way you talk. I love the way you're growing. All tigers and all people are different from each other. No one is a mistake, was Roger's message. All are worthy. And yet the host would not let Francois Clemens, Officer Clemens, a gay man, acknowledge his homosexuality in the 1970s, fearing that the show's corporate sponsors would disapprove and potentially cancel the show. Fred Rogers' own mistake, one that he would eventually rectify. Rogers would confess on occasion that it was tough to always look back with love and have confidence in the years ahead. Yet on the very last episode, on August 31st, 2001, as Washington Post reporter David Montgomery noted, Fred Rogers looked at the camera and said in that voice of unconditional love that can sound more sincere than one's own parents, I like being your television neighbor. It's such a good feeling to know you're alive. Fred Rogers died of stomach cancer less than 2 years after his show ended. But as one news headline assured us, Mr. Rogers lived on. His capital N neighborhood, that's actually the nonprofit name for everything that's Mr. Rogers now, it's capital N neighborhood, continued through reruns, Mr. Rogers' websites, educational books, and child development videos. There's the spin-off. Smithsonian National Museum of American History, where one of his trademark cardigan sweaters is actually on display, many of them knitted by his own mother. This year alone, the 50th anniversary of the premiere of his show in his neighborhood, the Postal Service will be putting Roger's face on a forever stamp, and the documentary on his life that came out this summer was a major success, held over in the theaters for a really long time. And there's a biopic starring Tom Hanks as Mr. Roger, which will be released next year, and he looks amazingly alike. On television, the nods to Rogers are still in evidence with a new program, Kidding, starring comedian Jim Carrey as Mr. Pickles, Mr. Rogers' look-alike host of a children's show whose calm and nurturing public persona is undermined by the death of his twin sons, one of his twin sons in a car crash and a split with his wife. But it's clear that Rogers would have been less thrilled with, perhaps even more than mildly unhappy, with becoming a posthumous icon, imitated by Jane Carey, than with leaving a legacy of helping children grow as confident, competent, and caring human beings, which is the mission of the Fred Rogers Center. There's actually a Fred Rogers Center housed in a Benedictine college. The center describes their work as promoting the power of human connection as the foundation of every child's healthy development. Whether as parents or educators or media creators or neighbors, each one of us, they believe, has a unique and enormous potential to nourish children's lives and make for what Mr. Rogers used to call happy, snappy new days. Happy, snappy new days by connecting with children. That's the legacy that Mr. Rogers won. It was the thesis of his life and his work, born from his own story, from his own Presbyterian theology, his own, now don't be too shocked, lifelong Republican conservative politics. But is that sufficient? The ongoing gift of the neighborhood to a child, we are told, was stability and tranquility in ritual and adventure in controlled doses. Roger created this in his show in a neighborhood that he literally constructed, that familiar step that only very rarely gave us a brief glimpse of an actual neighborhood. When he went on a dog walk, we took a short stroll to visit a lampshade hat maker. I kid you not, a lampshade hat maker. He walked around the block and you could see it. Generic neighborhood, you had no idea where it was or who lived there. A neighborhood, a district, an area, a locale, a quarter, a community. These are real places in real time. Some of you told me about a few of yours, playing outside until past dark with no end to the fun to be had. Playing kick the can, jumping rope, tricycle and bicycle riding, wagon pulling, climbing trees, setting stages for play productions, with so many people to play with and things to do. Some friendly grown-up neighbors, you told me, and some cranky ones. Another of you in a neighborhood with just a smattering of kids, but an amazing and precious small park with a basketball court. That was a neighborhood to you. My own childhood neighborhoods, too many of them, I would tell you, with more or less isolation, more or less stimulation, more or less companionship, many or fewer bullies, middle class, mostly white. Then there are the stories and studies I've been reading about and hearing about real neighborhoods. For example, last week a black man arrived at the entrance of the building that he lives in St. Louis, late on a Friday night, only to find himself blocked by a white neighbor who demanded proof that he actually lived there. It was only the latest instance of a white person caught on a video confronting a black person in their own neighborhood, performing everyday activities such as babysitting, or maybe eating lunch, or in 2018 going to a pool. It happens too frequently in my neighborhood that has been in transition as long as we have lived there. Alarmed reports of suspicious strangers, people who live there, people who've lived there for longer than the people who are complaining, people visiting their auntie or their grandmother who's lived there 40 years. Every week, I read about it in our neighborhood. And then the disparity between the conditions on the blocks that are nearly all or all white now and those just a few streets away, the bars on the windows still, the cracked sidewalks, the potholes, different neighborhoods, just a few blocks separated with a completely different quality of life and a completely different predictor for the outcome for those children, no matter how much they are loved on an individual basis. I don't always agree with columnist David Brooks, but in a piece this week titled Neighborhoods Are the Units of Change, he articulated that more that is necessary to assure that children and all people have any chance to thrive. He wrote that you probably heard of the starfish story, about the boy on the beach who found thousands of starfish washed up on the shore, dying, picks up one and throws it back in the ocean. A passerby asked him, "What's the point of that? All those other starfish are still going to die." "Well," the boy responded, "I saved that one." Many of our social programs, and indeed Fred Rogers' work, are based on that theory of social change, that we save people, or try to save people, one at a time. We pick a promising kid in a neighborhood and give her a scholarship, or we mentor children, one at a time, assuming that the individual is the most important unit of social change. Maybe the pool story is the better metaphor, Brooke writes, than the starfish story. As a friend of his put it, you can't just clean only the part of the pool you are swimming in. If you are trying to give real chances, if you're trying to improve real lives, maybe, he suggests, you have to start thinking about changing many elements of a neighborhood in a systemic way and at a steady pace. A few years back now, as part of the Unitarian Universalist anti-racist, anti-oppression, multicultural curriculum, Building the World You Dream About, our Atlanta congregation participated in an exercise where we walked or drove the area 1 mile out on all sides of our church building, like that, taking notes on what we saw, then reflecting and coming up with three areas of concern and possible action. So instead of being on automatic pilot on the way to lunch at Panera Bread Company, or on our way to pick things up at Target, armed with cameras and notebooks and our eyes wide open for a change, we really saw the pockets of marginal low-income housing with few bus stops. We saw the closed library. We saw that there was a food desert when the only supermarket shut down and a Quick Trip popped up instead. We saw the school with playground equipment in bad repair, and we saw the lack of sidewalks. We saw in our own neighborhood around our congregation. Well, what if you did the same thing right here? Travel a short or longer distance to see what neighborhood we live in the Auburn Unitarian Universalist Fellowship and the neighborhoods beyond. And what is it we might do to be their neighbors in larger and larger ways? As Mr. Rogers' mother would tell him, look for the helpers. You will always, always find people who are helping, which is a